Hi, I'm Chuck Seckinger, and welcome to Labor Relation Gigs in Small Bites. In this podcast, we will concentrate on the union construction market and explain all you need to know to understand the labor relations practices that are so unique to this industry. And we'll do it one step at a time in small bites. So let's go. Welcome to episode 5 of Labor Relation Gigs in Small Bites. I want to talk in this episode about a number of topics that I think are all related and important to understanding the union construction labor market in the U.S. The first is a description of the three construction approaches that are most common in the construction industry. The first being the union shop approach, formerly known as closed shop, but banned under the Taft-Hartley Act. A union shop is a collective bargaining agreement provision where all employees are required to become a member of the union and maintain their membership as a condition of their employment. In most construction CBAs, union membership is required no later than 8 days from the hire-in on a project. If you see this 8-day union membership requirement in a CBA, then you know it is a pre-hire 8F agreement specifically used only in the construction industry per Lanham Griffin Act. Another construction labor approach is the open shop approach, or called non-union, which, as you might expect, there is no CBA, and therefore there is no requirement for employees to join a union or be a member. Open shop contractors are not restricted by union work rules and work assignment jurisdiction or collectively bargained wages and benefit rights. But open shop contractors are on their own as far as the recruitment and training of their workforce. The last approach is called the merit shop approach, which is a term used to describe a project that has both a union workforce and a non-union workforce on the same project working on different scopes of work. For example, the project's civil work could be performed by a non-union workforce, but the electrical package could be awarded to a union contractor that would bring their own IBEW CBA to the project, applicable to only the electrical contractor's employees. The other open shop employees are not subject to this CBA and are only obligated to follow the conditions that their contractor has set in their human resources policy. I've talked about the union shop approach in the previous 4 episodes, starting in the mid-1800s and taking you up to the passage of our labor laws in 1935 with the National Labor Relations Act, also called the Wagner Act, the Taft-Hartley Act in 1947, and the Lanham-Griffin Act in 1959. But where does the story of American construction labor go from there? In the 1960s and 70s, wage increases in the union construction industry were staggering. In 1973, the wage gap between union workers and non-union construction workers was approximately 54%. Also during this period, contractors experienced a spike in strikes and work stoppages on job sites. As a result of these primary factors, union density, that is the percentage of employees who report themselves to be union members in the construction industry, dropped from 42% in 1970 to only 20% in the 1990s. Why did it drop in half in over 20 years? Well, contractors decided they needed to better control their project cost and productivity by pushing back on union shop work practices and the burdensome union fabrication conditions in the CBA. Also, the owners, that is, the CEOs from large industrial firms like Alcoa, General Electric, DuPont, and Exxon, who were the ultimate consumers of construction services, formed what is called the Construction Users Anti-Inflation Roundtable, or later called the Business Roundtable, which took an analytical look at labor costs in the union shop construction market. In 1974, they put out studies dealing exclusively with problems in the unionized sector of construction, such as jurisdictional issues, hiring halls, scheduled overtime, and the restoration of the role of management. Later in 1983, the Business Roundtable published further studies on collective bargaining and other relevant issues to both the union and open shop construction approaches. Although the Business Roundtable did not explicitly call for project owners to switch to the open shop, it engaged in a number of activities such as construction technology and government regulation that increased the likelihood of such switches. The Business Roundtable's effect on union density cannot be quantified. However, the end result was a dramatic decrease in union construction in oil and gas, industrial, and manufacturing private sector markets during that 10-year period. So where does union density in the construction industry stand today? Well, the Department of Labor's Bureau of Labor Statistics, BLS, shows that as of 2021, union membership share of the construction market was only 12.68%. But there are some interesting qualifiers that go with that figure. The BLS reports on union membership and combines that number with those employees represented by a collective bargaining agreement in the construction industry, but are not necessarily union members. That is, in right-to-work states where union membership cannot be made a mandatory condition of employment, those employees that are working under the protections of a CBA but are not required to be a union member are also counted as part of the BLS union density figure. I will be discussing those right-to-work state laws coming further on in this episode. With that combination of both the union shop and the union represented, the total union density in construction, as reported by the BLS, was 18.7%. Of course, this number of 18.7% in 2021, which included the pandemic years of 2020 and 2021, that saw dramatic increases and decreases in the employment numbers across all industries in the U.S., including construction. Also, another qualifier is that BLS reports the construction sector stats quite broadly and lumps in all establishments primarily engaged in the construction of buildings or engineering projects like highways and utility systems. This also includes single-family home building and even non-manual office staff. The BLS construction sector's total employment number in 2021 was 7.7 million workers. With all that in mind, it is difficult to come up with a solid firm number for union density in a relevant construction market or the market share of the union shop approach in the U.S. in the industrial market. An informed guess of union market share would be approximately 18 to 20% for today in 2022, which is still a significant number and about the same as it was in the 1990s. Although many open shop advocates will state that union membership number in the construction industry is 12.7%, as reported by the BLS in their union member summary published January 20th, 2022, remember, that number tells only half the story. Union shop advocates will taunt that 18 to 20% figure, which includes all construction workers covered by collective bargaining agreement. Also, keep in mind the way the BLS has defined construction is quite broadly and reflects job classifications that construction unions generally do not organize, and the added factor, which I have just mentioned, of separating union membership and working under union agreements, but not union members, as two different categories. Another factor to consider is the regionality of union density, especially in major metropolitan areas where construction skills are in great demand because of the area's constant growth and expansion. Metropolitan areas like New York, Newark, Boston Providence on the East Coast, and on the West Coast, Riverside, Sacramento, and California, Seattle, Tacoma, Washington, and Las Vegas, Nevada are all ranked highly for their union density in the general population. In addition to these metropolitan areas, states like Massachusetts, Rhode Island, New York, New Jersey, Maryland, Pennsylvania on the East Coast, Illinois, Minnesota in the Midwest, Colorado, New Mexico in the Mountain States, and Hawaii, California, Washington, Oregon, and on the West Coast also rank high as states in their total union density and population. It should be noted that none of the states I just mentioned are right-to-work states. What is meant by the term right-to-work? Well, it all started with the Taft-Hartley Act, signed in 1947, which repealed some parts of the National Labor Relations Act of 1935 by prohibiting the closed shop. In Taft-Hartley Section 14B, not only was the closed shop prohibited, but it also authorized individual states to outlaw a CBA's union security provision that required union membership after so many days past their hire date, such as union shop provisions that we see in construction pre-hire agreements, usually giving an 8-day window to join the union, or up to 30 days for 9A labor agreements used in all other industries. However, Taft-Hartley allowed for what is called agency shop provisions that gave employees an option to not be union member, but to pay an agency fee to the union for their collective bargaining services provided by the union representatives in the administration of the CBA they are working under. I talked about this earlier when I mentioned that the BLS keeps track on both union membership and union-represented employee figures. The distinction being those who are not union members are essentially free riders by not paying union dues but receiving the same benefits as union members, except they cannot vote on contract ratifications. Some states and court decisions have prohibited the payment of agency fees or limited those fees to solely the cost of administering the CBA, with no funding going to the union's political activities. Arguments can be made on both sides of the right-to-work issue. Advocates of such state laws have claimed freedom of contract and association, the right of a dissenting minority, and even religious freedom, since some faiths, such as the Jehovah's Witnesses, prohibit the joining of unions. Those on the other side of the argument will say right-to-work laws result in the right to work for less, since the bargaining power of the union is diminished by the deficiency of dues and solidarity at the bargaining table. The passing of such state laws are mainly the result not of a concern for human rights, but as part of a political process where Republican-dominated state legislatures have pushed for right-to-work laws to be passed as part of their pro-business agenda. Ultimately, the overall effect of right-to-work state laws has been an increase in job growth for businesses, but results in a greater economic inequality for their workers. There are currently 27 states with right-to-work laws on their books. Some have even embedded them into their state constitutions, but recently the state of Illinois has passed a referendum for an amendment to their constitution that established a right to collective bargaining and prohibits future state legislators from passing right-to-work laws in Illinois. I will note in most, if not all, CBAs used in the construction industry, there is always a requirement for the employer to use the union hiring halls as their primary source of referral of candidates for employment. Only when the union hiring hall cannot fulfill the employer's request for manpower, generally within a 48-hour period, can the employer seek candidates from other sources. We can presume that candidates being referred from a union hiring hall are mainly union members, and therefore the impact of right-to-work state laws on union shop construction projects is minimal, since the unions get the first bite of the apple and can call on neighboring unions to provide travelers, that is, journeymen that are willing to work in other than their own home local jurisdiction. My next subject is the Davis-Bacon prevailing wage rates that are applied to federal construction contracts and also what is called Little Davis-Bacon Acts, which set prevailing wage rates that are in effect in some states for their construction projects. Again, we start with the legislation to make sense of this subject of prevailing wage rates. The Davis-Bacon Act was passed in 1931 in an effort to require federal contractors to pay the prevailing wage rate established in the area of the project instead of bringing in workers from low-wage areas willing to work for less. The end result of not having this protection would be a diminishment of wages paid to local workers and an influx of non-resident transients who would be sending their wages back home and outside of the project location. In other words, political leaders that were instrumental in winning federal projects for their constituents would not reap the benefit of bringing back employment opportunities to their home district, a practice otherwise known as pork barreling. Ensuring that voters in their home districts would get the jobs as promised and defending the prevailing wage paid in the area prior to not going to the transient workers was the fundamental principal purpose for the worker protections established in the Davis-Bacon Act. Over the years, the task of establishing what the prevailing wage rate was for all counties and independent municipalities in states where federal projects could be built fell on the Department of Labor's Wage and Hour Division. The DOL established job classifications such as carpenters, laborers, plumbers, electricians, insulators, etc., specifically from the construction industry. They recognized these classifications as journeyman skills in the industry and then divided federal construction into building, heavy and highway, and residential practice. Also along the way, DOL included in the prevailing wage rate computation of what was the total benefit package cost paid by employers for their employees, such as pension, health and welfare, training, etc. Through annual surveys distributed to contractors and third parties, i.e. local unions, the DOL established a prevailing wage rate when the surveys indicated that at least 50% of the workers in a particular classification received a specific total rate in the county or independent city. In many cases, that specific rate was the union scale, as negotiated through collective bargaining between the local unions and their multi-employer bargaining groups. So, where the union density is prominent, such as in cities and large metropolitan areas, the prevailing wage rate, as detailed by DOL, are exactly equal to the union rates. However, this is still a function of how much the contractors and unions participate in these annual surveys. If you ever need a quick estimate of the cost of labor for a construction project at a particular state, county, or independent city, a good source would be the DOL website. Just Google wage determinations, sam.gov. The final topic of this episode is double breasting. This is a very intriguing name for the ability of a contractor to form union and non-union construction services subsidiaries under the same parent company and to do so without a challenge of an unfair labor practice claim by the unions for violation of the NLRA Section 8A5. In this case, the union would claim an employer failed to bargain in good faith by not recognizing the employees in the non-union company under the union contract signed by the union subsidiary. If proven in litigation that both subsidiaries are really just one company, the parent holding company would be in violation of its duty to bargain with the pre-existing union and therefore subject to the fact of the matter, the NLRB could grant the protections of a valid collective bargaining agreement to those non-union employees in the subsidiary company. This would result in the parent company being compelled to pay the same wages and benefits to all of its employees in the two subsidiary companies, which would incur back pay and unfunded pension liability, to say the least. Not only would there be an immediate financial impact to the parent company, but also a loss of future business, as many owners would prefer non-union construction services on their project, claiming such companies are better value for their construction dollar. As I noted earlier in this episode, many owners became aligned with the reports of the Business Roundtable, and a move began from unionized construction workforces to non-union workers, often undertrained and with minimal experience when compared to the union's apprenticeship programs and level of journeyman skills in the union trades. You might say the building trades union met their competition who provided a lower cost for service and were less subject to work stoppages. However, that open shop workforce were potentially inexperienced tradesmen underperforming on the job and getting injured because of lack of training while they were on the owner's property. During the 1980s and 90s, many large engineering and construction companies who had signed long-term national union contracts began to realize they were losing a substantial part of the construction market, that is, the one that was open shop only. These E&C companies, one by one, began to inform the unions they were signatory with that they wished to abrogate these long-term nationwide labor agreements at their contracts, terminations, or anniversary dates. Union work was moved to project labor agreements where the PLA was in effect only for the duration of construction of the project and expired after the project was completed and handed over to the owner. These large E&C parent companies were then unburdened by a national union contract binding them to build union anywhere across the country, and each began the process of either acquiring or starting a non-union subsidiary company so as to capture business on both sides of the union and non-union construction market. By 1983, 43 of the 50 largest contractors were unionized. However, of these 43 unionized companies, there were 22 that had double-breasted. This trend has continued to present day, where the double-breasting of parent companies is still quite common. As you might expect, these obvious moves by E&C firms did not go unnoticed by the unions, nor unchallenged. There are two landmark cases that set the parameters of double-breasting and how it could be performed without unfair labor practice charges. These two cases were John Delawa and Sons, Inc., 281 NLRB 184, 1987, and Peter Kiewit and Sons, 231 NLRB 76, 1977. It is not my intent to go into the details of these two cases, but I will give you the double-breasting guidelines that developed from these two cases, which are still in effect today. The first test guidelines for legally double-breasting as defined by NLRB case law is that contractors must establish that the two companies are not a single employer. That is done as part of a qualitative test that depends on the interrelation of the unionized and non-unionized companies, using such factors as common management and centralized control of labor relations. Also, the NLRB would look at whether the workers in the subsidiaries had a sufficient community of interest to be in the same bargaining unit. That is, where they perform the same work and under the same classifications. The board considers the bargaining history, the financial integration of operations, the differences in the type of work and skills of the employees, the extent of management control and supervision, and again, particularly in regards to labor relations, hiring, discipline, and control of day-to-day interchange, and frequency of contact between groups of employees working in the separate subsidiaries. A discovery that company equipment and staff are freely exchanged between the two companies would be seen as proof that it was a single company, and therefore the NLRA Section 8A5 violation would be sustained. Another test guideline established by the board was the alter ego doctrine. This would be a case where the unionized company's assets and business were transferred to the non-unionized affiliate company. Even though the original company would disappear in a legal sense, all that essentially that was changed was the name of the company and, of course, its collective bargaining status. The, quote, new company would be essentially populated by the same equipment, ownership, management, customers, and sometimes the same employees. Under this test, the successor company may be found to be the former company's alter ego, and the board would rule that the former company could not escape its collective bargaining obligations, regardless of whether there is a community of interest for the employees or not. I should note that there are not many challenges to the double-breasting of construction firms, and at some point, the companies have sought legal counsel to establish their companies with the necessary firewalls between the union and the open shop companies. One such firewall would pertain to officers and management staff being separate and not transferred back and forth between the two subsidiaries. One way, one time, for these personnel moves is the policy where the individual can be moved between the two subsidiaries, but must have a substantial separation and break in service from both the parent companies and the parent before they could work there again. The same would go for equipment not being borrowed between the two, as well as such internal services and company policies regarding safety, human resources, and even accounting. Needless to say, engineering and construction firms have been operating both as union and open shop when the projects they bid call for it, and as such, these companies have become agnostic to a preference for operating either way, since both construction methods can be very profitable if done right and established the correct way within the double-breasting guidelines I have discussed. I hope that I have shown you that the topics of this episode are very related. The construction approaches such as union shop, merit shop, and open shop are all well known in the construction marketplace. They lead to a stratification of the construction market, splitting the project work between union and non-union workforces. This leads to deltas between those workforces regarding cost, safety, and productivity. Regionality plays a large part in the forming of the unionized or non-unionized construction workforce, and such government practices regarding the prevailing wage rates in the area have helped keep the union movement alive in highly populated metropolitan areas. Finally, companies that have diversified to serve the union and non-union construction markets can provide either at will of the owner or on a perceived union strength or density of the area, as I described earlier. These companies have been set up consciously to comply with the established case law on double-breasting, and living within those guidelines has ensured a stable profit center for them in the construction business. In the next episode, I will talk about what happens when it all goes wrong, that is, strikes, job actions, pickets, work slowdowns, and company lockouts. I will be discussing how contractors and unions have been working through these issues and what lies ahead in the union construction labor market. Until then, be safe and be kind. References used for episode 5, Construction Approaches, Right to Work, Prevailing Wages, and Double-Breasting. A paper, Developments in Collective Bargaining in Construction in the 1980s and 90s, written by Stephen G. Allen, North Carolina State University, and the National Bureau of Economic Research, May 1993. Department of Labor, Bureau of Labor Statistics Report on Union Density in the Construction Industry, published January 20th, 2022. Department of Labor, Wage and Hour Division, Prevailing Wage Rates in the Construction Industry, SAM.gov. And NLRB Case Law, Double-Breasting in the Construction Industry. I'm Chuck Seckinger, Principal Consultant with Labor Relations Gigs. You can find more episodes at www.laborrelationgigs.com. Thank you for listening. Bye.